From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, incremental progress on the twin issues of the debt ceiling and the government shutdown. We'll have a report from Capitol Hill. As the Nobel Peace Prize goes to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, we hear from an analyst who says the award is a rebuke for the U.S.
Under the Bush administration, the United States was working very hard to undermine the organization.
Also, the massive housing bubble threatening the Netherlands, the inspiring words of Malala Yousafzai, and found on the other side of the world some of the missing episodes of Doctor Who.
We haven't been wasting our time. Well, I think you have.
I must agree with the boy doctor. You don't seem to have achieved very much.
Colonel, if you left us alone, we'd get along a lot quicker.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's headlines.
From FSN, I'm Kevin McAleese with the latest world news. Senate Republicans met with President Barack Obama as the shutdown dragged into the weekend. While the idea of a deal to reopen the government and lift the debt ceiling is drawing more optimism, it remains unclear what such an agreement would involve. Nina Maria Potts reports.
President Barack Obama is said to have pressed the 20 Republicans who met with him to reopen the government, which shut down 2 weeks ago after Congress failed to pass the budget. The latest polls show the Republican Party's been badly damaged in the ongoing government shutdown and debt limit standoff, and the offer to raise the debt ceiling temporarily is seen as a major breakthrough. But in return, the Republicans want White House concessions on reducing the deficit and a tax overhaul. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
The Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. The Hague-based OPCW is currently overseeing the removal of Syria's chemical weapons arsenal. But critics have expressed surprise at the award in a year when chemical weapons have been used inside Syria. Pakistani schoolgirl campaigner Malala Yousafzai has been widely tipped to win the $1.25 million prize. But the Nobel Committee said the OPCW deserved the award for its work on eliminating chemical weapons.
Recent events in Syria, where chemical weapons have again been put to use, have underlined the need to enhance the efforts to do away with such weapons. Actually, the committee never comments on those who didn't get the prize, simply because we are focusing on the one that has been awarded. There are a number of very good candidates, but only one can get the prize, which doesn't mean that all the other candidates, so to say, have been deleted.
A boat carrying more than 200 migrants has capsized off the coast of the Italian island of Lampedusa. A rescue operation is underway with reports that at least 120 people have been saved. It comes just a week after more than 300 migrants drowned when a boat capsized in the same area. Josephine McKenna is in Rome with the latest.
The boat seems to have capsized about 70 nautical miles southeast of Malta in the Channel of Sicily. There are Italian naval vessels and helicopters in the area, and I understand they're working with Maltese authorities to try and save as many people as possible. The Italian government estimates around 30,000 migrants have landed on Italian shores this year, and the government has been pressing the European Union a greater commitment to offer more funding to really step up these controls on the Mediterranean Sea to try and prevent these kinds of disasters from happening.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Spain's top national court has added former president of China Hu Jintao to its investigation of genocide in Tibet. Spanish judges took on the legal challenge after Madrid-based Tibetan activists, one of whom has Spanish nationality, made a formal appeal, though China's foreign ministry said on Friday that it was not a Spanish matter. Our European correspondent Sandra Gapman has more.
It's now been confirmed that Spain's national court will extend an existing case already investigating former Chinese President Jiang Zemin and six other Chinese officials to include ex-president Hu Jintao. Spain has been able to carry out the probe into Tibetan genocide on the grounds that the country's legal system recognizes the universal justice principle. It allows genocide suspects to be trialed outside their country, and because one of the Tibetan activists is in fact a Spanish citizen. China's ministry on Friday spoke out, saying the matter was of no relevance to Spain and hoped it will handle the issue properly. Sandra Gottman, Brussels.
African leaders are gathered in Ethiopia's capital to discuss a withdrawal from the International Criminal Court. The meeting comes amid growing criticism from some African states of the ICC. African correspondent Isabel Nakiria has details.
Some African leaders accuse the Hague-based ICC of being selective in prosecuting Africans ahead of alleged criminals from other countries. The meeting's being attended by Sudan President Omar Bashir, who has been indicted by the ICC. The summit also comes amid growing criticism from some African heads of state about ICC's prosecution of Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta and his deputy. Kenyatta is accused of crimes against humanity in the post-election violence of 2007. But despite growing hostility within Africa, a widespread withdrawal from the court is thought by many analysts to be unlikely at this stage.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Kevin McAleese reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
We better wake up. Defunding Obamacare is not achievable. So let's not delude our supporters by telling them that it is.
Senator John McCain speaking this morning on the Fox News channel and delivering an apparently unpalatable message that the latest opinion polls show his fellow Republicans have lost the argument publicly over the government shutdown and the soon-to-be-hit debt ceiling.
On the debt limit now, there are things that we could negotiate with the president about, some entitlement reforms, some tax reforms, things that are achievable. Defunding Obamacare is not one of them.
Well, we'll see, how the package gets put together.
I guarantee it. You know, not only will you see, I guarantee it.
All right.
The sigh of a Fox News anchor ending that interview with Senator McCain. Up on Capitol Hill today, House Republicans floated the offer of a bill that would both reopen the government and raise the debt ceiling. But as Alice Olstein reports, they're demanding deep cuts to social safety net programs in return.
The new proposal from House Republicans would reopen the government as early as next week and delay the risk of a debt ceiling default until November 20th. Leaving time for negotiations with Democrats and the White House on changes to the Affordable Care Act and or so-called entitlement programs. Massachusetts Democrat Jim McGovern, a member of the Progressive Caucus, said the proposal concerns him.
It is very important that we protect the social safety net. Look, government is primarily there for the most vulnerable. Slashing $40 billion out of SNAP or the food stamp program or cutting WIC or cutting Head Start. I mean, that's, in my opinion, the absolute wrong way to go. So the bottom line is I would be very much opposed to balancing the budget on the backs of the poor. And I'm hoping the president would be, and I'm assuming the Democratic Senate would be. So whatever agreement they come to, I think they're mistaken if they think they got to get away with just, taking money out of programs that help the most vulnerable.
Rank-and-file Republicans say they don't know exactly what their leaders will propose, but many representatives said they wanted something like the reforms outlined in Paul Ryan's budget, which sought to cut Medicaid by more than $7.5 billion, deny food stamps to millions of people who currently use them, and drastically reduce spending on welfare, education, and health care. Louisiana Republican John Fleming said while his first priority would be delaying the Affordable Care Act.
But I'm not going to say that something else instead would make me not support it, such as, again, entitlement reform. High, high priority in my view. I'd be interested in looking at, are there other things we could do maybe to incentivize citizens to work a little later in life? And that could be a win-win.
Entitlement reform is a term frequently heard in hearings and press conferences on Capitol Hill over the past few days, as Republican leaders have largely shifted their demands away from the Affordable Care Act and revived their longtime push to make sweeping changes to national programs that support the poor and the elderly. McGovern said Democrats' support for the debt ceiling measure will depend on exactly what leaders mean when they say entitlement reform.
The devil is in the details. So what do they mean by that? Do they mean that Mrs. O'Leary will not get a cost of living adjustment in her Social Security check when she's living on $15,000 a year? Do they mean, taking food stamps away from poor people or from veterans who unfortunately have to rely on it? So I don't know what they mean by entitlement reform. Look, can we do the social safety net better? Yes, we can. But, you know, their definition of entitlement reform and my definition of entitlement reform are different.
Though House lawmakers on both sides of the aisle said Friday that they have no idea what provisions were in the new plan, a vote could come as soon as Friday evening. The Senate is expected to vote on their own bill to raise the debt ceiling this weekend, a version that has no policy provisions attached, but that may not survive a Republican filibuster. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
As the government shutdown goes into its second weekend, it is an odd time to be here in Washington, D.C. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers laid off, some restaurants offering discounted lunches to furloughed government employees, others warning members of Congress they'll have to pay a premium for eating within them. Tourists have been bemused to discover that the city's famed free-to-enter museums, run with public money, are closed, but others are packed. Privately run institutions like the Spy Museum are only affected by the shutdown because of the uptick in business that it's brought them. FSN's Rebecca Foster went out today and spoke to the Spy Museum's Jason Worden and asked him how the shutdown has been affecting things.
The Spy Museum's in a unique position, even among this very convoluted situation, that we're a private institution. So our doors remain open, and we invite all the visitors to D.C. who are losing options of where they can go to come visit us. And as you saw coming in today, we have a very high influx of visitors, particularly with the weather being a contributor as well. So while a number of our neighbors across the mall, including a number of the Smithsonian institutions, are losing place in their visitors all week, we are seeing an uptick in so many people coming through our door. So we're taking advantage of what's a very convoluted situation.
How much traffic do you guys see on a typical week? And do you have any numbers to suggest an increase this week?
We've certainly seen an influx in visitors due to the government shutdown. Our numbers are much higher the past 2 weeks based off of what we had forecasted. And we're hoping to see that continue over the next, say, week and a half, depending on how long this continues.
Have you heard any of the visitors to the Spy Museum talking about how the shutdown is affecting the rest of their plans?
We have. A number of folks have called in booking group tours, and they had many different options originally what they were going to do, and they had this trip planned for months and months, and then you hear that the government shut down and your entire plan is shot.
Jason Worden of the very busy Spy Museum. You're listening to FSN Reports.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided that the Nobel Peace Prize for 2013 is to be awarded to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, for its extensive work for eliminating chemical weapons.
The announcement made in Oslo this morning that has put the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons on the front pages of newspapers and websites around the world. The OPCW's work in Syria is just getting underway, but as the implementing body of the Chemical Weapons Convention, it's been trying to rid the world of some of its most heinous weapons since 1997. Earlier today, I spoke to Stephen Zunis, a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, and I asked him for his reaction to the Nobel Committee's decision.
Well, on the one hand, my personal preference has always been for individuals struggling for social justice rather than international organizations. I think that the OPCW is actually a very worthy choice.
And in the statement that the OPCW director made shortly after the news was announced, he said that one of the advantages of the OPCW being awarded this is that it can bring attention to the work that still has to be done on the issue of chemical weapons, including work that needs to be done in the United States.
That's true. The United States is behind its obligations to complete the disarmament project that was supposed to have been completed last year. And at this point, it looks like it's going to be 2020 at the earliest. Nevertheless, the fact that the OPCW has been successful in disarming close to 80% of the world's chemical weapons arsenal since its creation, I think, is indicative of a highly successful effort.
Now, I know that you've described the award of the Nobel Peace Prize to the OPCW as something of a rebuke for the United States. Why do you see things in those terms?
Well, under the Bush administration, the United States was working very hard to undermine the organization, successfully engineering the firing of its highly effective first director general, Jorge Bustani. The concern was not only was Bustani seeking to inspect U.S. Chemical weapons facilities with the same rigor they were other nations, but that they're on the verge of getting an agreement with Iraq to sign on to the Chemical Weapons Convention, which would have allowed inspectors into the country, and had they done so, they would have discovered that Iraq had, in fact, eliminated its arsenal some years earlier, thereby undermining the primary rationale for the prospective U.S. invasion of Iraq. And so I think the main problem was that while the U.S. position has traditionally been fairly selective in its efforts at disarmament, depending on a country's relations with the United States, take, for example, Israel and Egypt continuing to possess chemical weapons and having refused to ratify Chemical Weapons Convention. The OPCW has stressed the concept of universality, that all countries must abide by this disarmament regime.
And how do you assess the Obama administration's record in terms of its relationship with the OPCW?
Certainly an improvement over that of President Bush. And despite being behind in the disarmament efforts here and not putting the same kind of pressure on its allies as it has on Syria, the very fact that they were willing to accept the possibility of the OPCW coming in to eliminate the Syrian regime's arsenal rather than launching a war is indicative of a greater openness to such multilateral efforts.
By giving the award to the OPCW now, as they're just beginning their work in Syria, does that give added impetus to the work that lies ahead for them, or is there a danger of giving them this award before the work in Syria is complete?
Well, they have already demonstrated a very good track record in their disarmament efforts so far. Indeed, the head of the Nobel Committee emphasized this, that this was recognition not just of the more recent efforts in Syria, but their track record since their formation back in 1997. I think the advantage here is that by gaining this greater recognition, it makes it more difficult for those in the West pushing for military intervention to make their case. It's a recognition that international organizations that are dedicated to disarmament are really the way to go and not the kind of unilateralism that many have been pressing for.
Professor Stephen Zunis from the University of San Francisco. Now, at a time when it's easy to be cynical in Washington, D.C., a 16-year-old girl challenged everyone today not to be. Malala Yousafzai was in the U.S. Capitol today addressing an audience at the World Bank about her fight for girls' education. Shot in the head by the Taliban in Pakistan last year for highlighting the cause on a national and global level, she's just published a memoir called I Am Malala. And she answered questions from the World Bank's president, Dr. Jim Yong Kim, who asked if she had a message for the U.S. government.
If I talk really from my heart, and if I look at the United States of America, only to the government of the United States of America, we all know that people in suffering countries like Pakistan, Afghanistan, are really angry with the United States. I think the best way to fight terrorism is not through guns. If you want to end a war through a war, it's never going to end. Much of the money is spent on making tanks, on making guns. Much of the money is spent on soldiers. We need to spend the same money on books, on pens, on teachers and on schools. So the governments must take an action. It's the duty of the governments. It's their duty. We vote them. not to make them able to take a decision according to their views and according to their ideas. We vote them to listen to us. We vote them to listen to what we say. And we ask them now that work for education of every child. And do not fight through guns. Fight through pens and through books. And take education serious. So I think that the government must take an action.
The inspiring words of Malala Yousafzai appearing today at the World Bank in Washington, D.C. And you'll hear much more of that event in a special Columbus Day edition of our programme this coming Monday. Now to the Netherlands, where the bursting of a massive housing bubble is prolonging the country's recession and leaving homeowners and banks sitting on mountains of debt. Over 1 million people in the Netherlands are now facing negative equity, owning more on their homes than their homes are worth. And as unemployment rises, making mortgage payments is, for many, a continuing struggle. So some are embracing unconventional solutions to meet their housing needs, as FSN's Natalie Fiery discovered in the city of Rotterdam.
A massive vault which once housed the valuables of people living in Rotterdam is the basement of Gidget Mau Assam's home. On the ground floor, which is now boarded up, the counters where bank tellers once served customers still stand. Gidget is among the growing number of people in the Netherlands that cannot afford to pay market rent, as she feels the impact of Holland's third year in a recession. So when she was offered the opportunity to live in the former ABN AMRO Bank building, she jumped at the chance.
Instead of leaving the building empty, they place people in it for a small amount of money, and we're just like cheap security people.
The 42-year-old artist lives on the first floor of the vast former office space, which also serves as her art studio.
All my friends, when they come at my place, they say, wow, it's amazing what you can do with so little and so much space and still make it feel homey.
Living in the former ABN AMRO building has helped Gidget get back on her feet after her debts mounted up when she lost her job. But ABN AMRO is still struggling since being nationalised during the financial crisis. Bad mortgage debts the bank holds are piling up. Dutch financial institutions are estimated to be holding over 650 billion euros worth of mortgage loans, and the housing market crash shows no signs of bottoming out. House prices have fallen 20% since 2008 and are set to fall a further 5% this year. A staggering one-third of Dutch homeowners now owes more on their mortgages than their homes are worth. James Howard, European economist at Capital Economics, says the Dutch government was largely to blame.
You saw a decade of debt-fueled boom in the housing market that meant that households could borrow up to 120% of the value of their home as a mortgage.
Mortgage tax breaks handed out by the government cost the Dutch taxpayer an estimated 14 billion euros a year, by the same government that was quick to criticise other Eurozone members for excessive spending and that is now scrambling to get its own financial house in order. But many people in Holland are unhappy with the approach, including Piet Vogels, the head of the economics desk at the AD newspaper.
We have room to expand the economy, spend some money and repair it later. We always say, well, we're repairing the roof while it's raining, and you must do it when the sun shines.
And as the debate in Holland about strict austerity measures intensifies, opposition to the government's plans is mounting, particularly as other countries like France and Germany are starting to see growth. So Holland finds itself among the laggards in the Eurozone. And there is more pain to come, with the government implementing over 4 billion euros worth of tax hikes and budget cuts to try to get the country's deficit under control. Natalie Fiery, Rotterdam.
If
if that music stirs something deep within you. You are a Whovian, a fan of the British television series Doctor Who, whose time-travelling hero and his companions have been delighting fans for almost 50 years. Now they've unexpectedly got some fresh episodes to watch. Not new ones, but episodes of the programme produced back in 1967 and 1968 and thought to be lost forever, until they suddenly turned up earlier this year in the archive of a TV station in the city of Jos in Nigeria. Simon Thompson is a journalist covering the entertainment industry in Britain, and he spoke to FSN's Kevin McAleese.
Even with Doctor Who's time-travelling abilities, the last place you'd expect to find any of his last episodes that have been, they've been gone for sort of 40, 50 years, would be in a town in Nigeria. These are actually quite important pieces of footage as well. There's a lot of stuff that went missing, you know, from the early days of the show. And for those of you that aren't familiar with the show, Doctor Who is about a Time Lord who travels through time and space, fighting for the injustices of you know, beings on various planets. And they just disappeared. A lot of the stuff got deleted by the BBC, and some stuff just vanished. These are big stories. They're from important parts of the Doctor Who history, and they're almost mythical status for some Doctor Who fans who thought that these stories that had once been broadcast would never be found again, and here they've turned up.
The BBC say they'll officially confirm the find with a screening next week. However, they haven't wasted any time making these episodes available globally to the public. Is that right?
Well, the fact that they're already available to buy on iTunes and in a number of countries around the world are already at the top of the charts. You know, anything to do with Doctor Who, like many sci-fi franchises, is instantly going to be a moneymaker. And you want to be the first person, especially in the world of piracy that we're living in. You don't want it leaking out. If it's going to get out, you want to make some money off it. Now, there is a massive audience for this stuff, and Doctor Who fans, like Star Trek fans and Star Wars fans, will pay good money for this stuff to see it as quick as humanly possible. So it doesn't surprise me at all that even before the official announcement has come, with any pomp and circumstance or ceremony at all, that this has actually come out. It's also no inconvenient truth that this is happening in the 50th year of Doctor Who. In the UK, in the next sort of month or so, there's going to be a number of events celebrating the 50th anniversary of the show. So the fact that these have turned up now, they're instantly available. Cynical people would say that perhaps this is a bit of a rather convenient marketing ploy. Others would say it's just good luck.
I suppose this discovery, it begs the question, what other buried broadcasting treasure is still out there to be found?
Well, exactly. That's the big question. But Doctor Who is not the only thing where pieces of film have gone missing. Metropolis is a 1920s Fritz Lang German movie that constantly new bits of that are being found in sheds around Germany or in Rio or randomly around Hollywood or in people's collections. Films like Blade Runner, we've had several versions of that film. I think the appeal of this, and I think the fact that it's going to be financially viable for all involved to find bits of missing TV shows and films, I think anybody who doesn't now start searching around their attics would perhaps be foolhardy.
Simon Thompson on the news that has excited Doctor Who fans young and old the world over. You can follow him on Twitter at ShowbizSimon. And as Doctor Who's theme plays us out tonight, you can follow us on Twitter at FeatureStory. You can email us too, reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And that is the Friday edition of FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks in Washington alongside producer Kevin McAleese. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.